In a clean lit room of midnight screens, we line up families 3x3. Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So today we are doing a deep dive into some truly fascinating source material about rare genetic diseases. And, you know, our mission today is really to uncover how standard medical tests might actually be completely blind to a massive underlying issue.
Right. It is a huge blind spot in the field right now.
Because, I mean, when we look at standard clinical diagnostics, we tend to expect a certain level of, like, absolute engineering precision, right?
Oh, absolutely. We expect a simple binary output.
Exactly. You run the test, the algorithm filters the data, and it just delivers that binary answer. The patient either has the pathogenic variant or they don't.
Yeah, it's a system entirely built on strict thresholds, which, you know, usually works perfectly for standard inherited conditions.
But then you step into the world of rare genetic diseases, and suddenly that algorithmic certainty sort of becomes a liability. I mean, imagine looking at a child diagnosed with a really severe unexplained genetic condition. You run whole genome sequencing on the family trio, and the results come back showing that both parents are completely clear.
They appear totally genetically unaffected.
Right. So standard clinical medicine tells you this was just a tragic random fluke, a classic de novo mutation arising brand new in the child.
Which is the standard narrative genetic counselors have relied on for decades based on those trio results.
But I want you to consider what really happens when a mutation occurs just a few days after fertilization. We're talking about a microscopic window in time when a parent-to-be is nothing more than, like, an 8-cell embryo.
Just a tiny cluster of cells.
Yeah. How could a minuscule timing difference, I mean, a copying error made before a parent even developed differentiated tissues, how could that completely blind our most advanced medical sequencing tests to a hidden genetic risk?
Well, it basically creates the ultimate diagnostic blind spot, because our current pipelines simply aren't calibrated to look for errors that lock in that early in human development.
It kind of makes me think of inspecting a house for structural integrity. I mean, standard genetic testing is like checking the completed house by tearing open a single piece of drywall in the kitchen. But it completely ignores the fact that a tiny, nearly invisible error was written into the very first blueprint draft.
Right, the foundational draft.
Exactly. And because it was in that early draft, the error was meticulously copied, but only into half the rooms. So by just testing the kitchen, you completely miss the structural flaw sitting quietly in the living room.
And, you know, this isn't just some theoretical gap in the literature. As we explore the source material today, we are looking at a real phenomenon where this blueprint error is actively occurring, and our sequencing algorithms have just systematically erased the evidence.
Today, we celebrate the work of the team at the Wellcome Sanger Institute and Genomics England, who have advanced our understanding of parental post-zygotic mutations and rare disease diagnosis.
It's incredible work. And to really grasp the clinical flaw they are addressing, we need to look at how diagnostic pipelines handle variant allele fractions, or VAF for short.
Okay, so VAF.
Yeah, VAF. Yeah. So as we know, standard de novo mutations, or DNMs, they arise quite late in the parental timeline. They are specifically isolated in the adult sperm or egg cells.
So they're genuinely brand new to the familial line. Like, the parent's somatic tissues, their blood, their skin are completely free of the mutation.
Precisely. But a parental post-zygotic mutation, a PZM, that occurs in those first 10 to 15 cellular divisions right after fertilization.
Long before the embryo separates into somatic and germline lineages, right?
Exactly. And because the mutation happens before that split, the parent actually grows up as a mosaic. The mutation populates a small fraction of both their somatic tissues, like their blood, and their germline cells.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because, you know, the parent is healthy. The mutation isn't widespread enough in their body to actually trigger the disease phenotype.
Right, it's just a tiny fraction of their cells.
But it is hiding in their reproductive cells.
Mm-hmm.
So when this family goes in for testing, how exactly does the diagnostic algorithm fail them? I mean, what's the glitch?
Well, it fails because of very rigid logic gates. When the clinical pipeline looks at the family trio, it expects a parent who is a carrier to show the variant in roughly 50% of their reads.
A standard heterozygous state.
Yeah, standard heterozygous. But our mosaic parent, they might only have the variant in, say, 5% of their blood cells. The algorithm flags that 5% VAF as just way too low and firmly declares not a carrier.
But the child's sequencing will show the mutation at 50%, right? Because they inherited it straight from that one affected gamete.
Yes, exactly. So the algorithm looks at the child's 50% VAF, looks back at the parent's seemingly negative status, and categorizes it as a de novo mutation.
A brand new fluke.
Right. But here is the fatal flaw in the software. To finalize a DNM diagnosis, the pipeline runs a really strict quality control check. It requires absolute zero evidence of the variant in the parent's blood.
Oh, wow. I see the collision here.
Yeah.
Because the parent is a mosaic, there actually is a tiny trace in their blood.
Exactly. The pipeline sees that trace, you know, maybe 3 mutant reads out of 100, and the algorithmic logic basically collapses.
It just can't compute it.
Right. It says, well, the parent isn't a carrier because the VAF is only 5%, but it cannot be a de novo mutation because the parental blood isn't perfectly clean.
Right.
So unable to place it in either bucket, the pipeline assumes that tiny biological signal must just be a machine sequencing artifact.
You just dumps it in the digital trash bin. I mean, that is staggering. The diagnostic pipelines are essentially filtering out the most crucial piece of evidence just because it doesn't fit neatly into the inherited or brand new buckets.
That's a massive blind spot.
So how did this research team actually build a bioinformatic net to catch these variants slipping through the cracks?
Well, they turned to the Genomics England 100,000 Genomes Project, utilizing data from 12,015 rare disease family trios.
That is a huge data set.
It is. And they started with 5.7 million Mendelian inconsistencies. Those are sites where a child has a variant that both parents supposedly lack.
Okay, that makes sense.
So to find the PZMs, they completely bypassed that strict zero evidence rule and actively hunted for just one or more alternative reads in a single parent.
Wow, just one read.
Yeah. That initial sweep flagged 2.5 million candidates, which they eventually filtered down to 1,015 high-confidence early parental PZMs.
Okay, I have to jump in here and challenge the methodology, mathematically speaking.
Yeah.
Because they are using standard depth clinical data, right? 30x coverage.
That is correct. Standard clinical depth.
So that means the sequencing machine only read any given piece of DNA about 30 times. If a parent is a 5% mosaic, well, 5% of 30 reads is just 1.5.
Right, exactly.
You are literally looking for one or two stray signals in a sea of normal DNA. So how do you mathematically distinguish a true 5% mosaic mutation from, say, a random sequencing error or machine noise?
That is the exact mathematical hurdle that has kept this whole field stalled for so long. Historically, detecting mosaicism required ultra-deep sequencing, maybe 200x or 300x coverage.
Which is incredibly expensive.
Right, or you'd need incredibly expensive multi-generational testing. But this team proved you can bypass that physical testing with rigorous statistical integration.
So what did they do differently?
They didn't just count the variant reads, they analyzed the multi-dimensional metadata attached to them.
What kind of metadata separates the biological signal from just digital noise?
First, they looked at FRED quality scores, which basically measure the sequencer's confidence in every single base call.
Okay.
If you have a variant supported by just two reads, but both have exceptionally high quality scores, the statistical probability of it being a random machine error drops dramatically.
That makes a lot of sense.
Then they checked for strand bias. Sequencing reads DNA in two directions, forward and reverse. A lot of machine artifacts are just optical illusions that only happen in one direction.
I see.
Right, so if the variant only showed up on forward reads, the pipeline threw it out. It had to be present in both directions to prove it was a physical reality on the actual DNA strand.
So it's really not just the quantity of the evidence, it's the strict pedigree of those one or two reads. They mathematically modeled the expected error distributions and basically penalized anything that looked like technical noise.
Precisely. By integrating read depth, allele balance, and mapping quality, they successfully isolated those 1,015 needles from the genomic haystack.
Incredible.
It really proved you can find these early developmental mutations in data that is already sitting right there on clinic servers.
Okay, let's unpack this. Or rather, let's look at what the actual biology looked like once they had this pristine data set of hidden post-zygotic mutations. What did they find?
The first metric they plotted was timing via the variant allele fraction. Those 1,015 mutations formed a really distinct monomodal distribution centered beautifully around 5% VAF.
Okay, and if you run the math on synchronous embryonic cell division, a 5% mosaicism maps back to an event occurring at roughly the third cell division, right?
Yes, exactly. An embryo consisting of just 8 cells. And because they locked in so early, the demographic data severely diverges from what we see with standard de novo mutations.
How so?
Well, with DNMs, there is a massive parental age bias. Because they arise in adult tissues, the older a parent is at conception, the more DNMs they pass on.
Oh, right, the classic aging effect. But these PZMs showed zero parental age bias, didn't they?
Not at all, which perfectly aligns with the biology. I mean, these mutations happen in the first days of life, decades before parental aging even becomes a factor.
Wow.
Furthermore, there was no sex bias. The mutations were split almost perfectly down the middle, with about 52.3% occurring in fathers.
Why is the lack of a sex bias a significant finding here?
Because it completely upends assumptions based on animal models. In mice, there is a strong paternal bias for early mutations.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because male primordial germ cells specify much earlier in development than female ones in mice. The fact that human data shows basically a coin flip proves our early developmental mechanisms operate quite differently.
We cannot simply port the mouse developmental timeline over to humans.
Exactly. We are not just big mice.
Okay, let's unpack this next part. Specifically, the mutational spectrum itself, the actual letters of DNA being swapped. Because the paper notes that PZMs have a negative association with GC-rich regions of the genome.
Right.
That is the exact opposite of what we see with standard de novo mutations. Plus, PZMs are highly enriched for C2A and T2A substitutions and depleted in T2C compared to DNM.
Yes, the spectrum is very distinct.
But I have a biological contradiction I need you to explain.
Okay, go ahead.
If the paper says both PZMs and DNMs are driven by the exact same clock-like mutational signatures, I think they said SBS1 and SBS5?
Yes, SBS1 and SBS5.
Right, so those are the background engines of DNA damage. If the underlying mechanism causing the damage is identical, how can their final mutation spectrums look so fundamentally flipped?
That is the big paradox of this data set, right? How can the exact same machinery produce two totally different outputs?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to make sense.
Well, the answer doesn't lie in the damage engine itself. It lies in the changing chemical landscape of the DNA. Think of it like applying a heavy chemical rust-proofing treatment to a car.
Okay, rust-proofing.
In adult tissues, where DNMs occur, the genome is heavily coded in methyl groups. DNA methylation.
Right.
Counterintuitively, heavily methylated cytosines in GC-rich regions are actually highly chemically unstable. They spontaneously deminate, basically turning into thymine.
So in the adult genome, the quote-unquote rust-proofing actually creates the vulnerabilities.
Exactly. But now, cut back to the 8-cell embryo. Right after fertilization, the embryo undergoes a massive wave of epigenetic reprogramming.
It strips it all away.
Yes, it physically strips almost all of that methylation away in a process called DNA demethylation. The genome is essentially stripped bare to reset the developmental slate.
Wow, so the physical environment of the DNA completely changes.
Yes. During those early cell divisions, those GC-rich regions are unmethylated and temporarily very stable. Background damage engines, SBS1 and SBS5, they are still ticking away, but the physical vulnerability of the DNA has shifted. Therefore, the damage manifests entirely differently, resulting in that unique C2A and T2A substitution pattern that avoids the GC-rich regions entirely.
That is a stunning piece of biology. The epigenetic software reset of the early embryo actually physically dictates where the genetic hardware is vulnerable to mutation.
It's beautiful, isn't it? It perfectly bridges the gap between developmental biology and mutational signatures.
Okay, so we have this elegant bioinformatic pipeline. We understand the statistical mass that bypasses those clinical blind spots, and we've decoded the embryonic biology. But let's bring this back down to the ground. So what does this all mean for a family sitting in a genetics clinic staring at an unexplained diagnosis?
Well, the clinical translation is immediate, and it is profound. By simply running standard data through this new lens, the team recovered 917 previously untested PZMs.
Over 900.
Yes. These were variants directly causing rare diseases that standard pipelines had essentially erased from existence.
And just found the answers hiding in plain sight.
They really did. For instance, they isolated a hidden variant in a gene called DYNC1H1 in a child suffering from severe seizure disorders.
Oh, wow.
The variant was a somatic mosaic in an unaffected parent, successfully transmitted to the child, and entirely missed by routine diagnostics.
That's heartbreaking, but also amazing that they finally found it.
They found another one in the WT1 gene, which is linked to severe congenital anomalies of the kidney and urinary tract, including hydroureter and vesicoureteral reflux.
And again, a mosaic parent passed it on, and the standard test just ignored it.
Exactly, it was just filtered out completely.
The idea that hundreds of case files were just closed simply because an algorithm hit a logic loop,
yeah,
it's honestly chilling.
It is, and you know, it goes even deeper than just missing diagnoses. The pipeline also identified 98 variants that standard pipelines actually did find, but fundamentally misclassified as brand new de novo mutations.
Oh, like what?
Like a VMP2 variant linked to global developmental delay.
But wait, if the standard pipeline still found the mutation and gave the child the diagnosis, why does it really matter if it was misclassified as a DNM instead of a PZM? I mean, they still got the answer right.
Because while the child gets the diagnosis, the family is handed the completely wrong future.
What do you mean by that?
Think about it. If a geneticist tells a family, hey, this was a de novo mutation, a completely random fluke of nature, that family naturally assumes they are safe to have another child. The quoted recurrence risk is effectively zero.
Oh, wow. I see the immense gravity of this now.
Right, because if that mutation is actually a parental PZM, the parent is a mosaic carrier. A significant percentage of their gametes carry that exact devastating mutation.
So the recurrence risk is not zero?
Not at all. It could be 5%, 10%, or even higher. It completely alters family planning. Telling a family that lightning won't strike twice, when one parent is actually a biological carrier, is a catastrophic clinical failure.
The emotional and practical weight of that, I mean, the difference between a 1 in a million fluke and a 10% recurrence risk is literally everything to a family.
Exactly. It changes lives.
Are there bounds to this new pipeline, though? I mean, it can't magically catch everything, right?
No, it is bounded by the mathematics of the 30x sequencing data.
Right, the 30 reads.
Yeah, so if a mutation happens very late in development, say, resulting in just a 1% VAF, there simply aren't enough reads to statistically differentiate it from machine noise.
That makes sense.
Conversely, if it happens at the very first cell division, the VAF might push above 14%.
And what happens then?
At that high level, standard pipelines start misclassifying it as a regular heterozygous inherited variant, and it gets filtered out for entirely different algorithmic reasons.
Ah, yes.
So this specific bioinformatic net is perfectly woven to catch the middle ground, those mutations happening roughly between the third and the fifth cell divisions.
So synthesizing this deep dive, parental postzygotic mutations really represent a vastly under-recognized origin of rare genetic diseases. For years, our digital infrastructure has been actively suppressing the evidence because algorithms demand binary states that biological mosaicism just doesn't respect.
That's a great way to summarize it.
But by intelligently applying a highly stringent statistical lens to existing standard depth clinical sequencing, we can recover lost diagnoses and accurately map recurrence risks without needing a single new physical text.
The data is literally sitting on the clinic servers right now. We just needed to realize that the biological smudges on the blueprint were actually the answers we were looking for.
And, you know, when we consider how these early mutations can silently propagate through both somatic and germline tissues, we really have to look beyond just rare pediatric diseases. Could these exact same postzygotic mutations be planting the hidden early seeds of late-onset cancers decades before a tumor ever forms? What does this mean for the thousands of families still waiting for an answer from their genetic tests? This episode was based on an open-access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you just heard about. Thanks for listening and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
In a clean lit room of midnight screens, we line up families 3 by 3. A whisper flickers in the parents' red. Not loud enough for rules to see, but it's there, like static in the gene. Not a full-blown signal, not a perfect clone. Just early split lightning in the bone. Clockwork marks on a crown.
crooked page. Same old hands, a different shade. 5% of the truth in the bloodline glow. Hidden the noise where the pipelines don't go. If you dig the cracks, you can change what you know. A missed little mosaic can point the way home. T2A like ash in a sudden flare. T2A like footsteps on hospital stairs. Less T to C than we'd expect to find. And GC deserts where it thins out the sign. Still SBS 1, SBS 5, keep time. Don't call it rare, call it overlooked. A quiet variant in the book. But Brianna O'Day, what you already read. Bloodline glow, pulled from standard depth with a careful slow. When the trio says no, there's a softer yes below. A missed little mosaic can point the way home. 5% of the truth. And the future opens wide. Bye. 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 Bye.